Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates, family, and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you are calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
In Gaza, medics and civil defense workers are still recovering bodies from mass graves found at the Nasser Medical Complex for the sixth day in a row following Israel's siege on the hospital. Over 320 bodies have so far been discovered, including women, children, patients, and medical staff, according to Al Jazeera. Another mass grave with up to 400 bodies was discovered weeks earlier at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Civil defense officials have said bodies were found stacked together and showed indications of field executions or being buried alive. The United Nations and the European Union have called for an independent probe into the mass graves, and the White House on Wednesday also called for an investigation. This comes as Israel continues its bombardment of Gaza, with at least 43 people killed over the last 24 hours, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. At least five of them were killed in the southern city of Rafah, where Israel has conducted near-daily airstrikes as it prepares for an offensive in the city.
A spokesperson for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government told Reuters Israel is moving ahead with a ground operation in Rafah, but gave no timeline. An unnamed Israeli defense official said Israel had bought 40,000 tents, each able to hold between 10 and 12 people, to house Palestinians evacuated from Rafah ahead of its assault on the city. Israeli news outlets report Israel will forcibly evacuate civilians to the nearby city of Khan Yunis, which has been virtually destroyed by Israeli forces. Over 1.3 million Palestinians are seeking shelter in Rafah, the southernmost city in Gaza. We go now to Rafah in Gaza, where we're joined by Akram Al-Sattari, a journalist based in Gaza. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Akram. Just moments ago, Palestinian officials held a press conference in Rafah regarding the mass graves at the Nasser Medical Complex. Can you tell us the latest? I know there's a delay in the broadcast.
Good morning, Amy, to you and all the viewers. I have just come back from Khan Yunis area. I was at Nasser Hospital. I spoke to the civil defense officer who is now giving this press conference about the situation in Nasser Hospital and about the number of the people who are killed, the way they were killed, and an account of the potential suffering they have been seeing even before their death. It looks like the mass graves, the three different mass graves, are containing around 700 bodies up to this particular moment. Around 400 bodies were unearthed and discovered. Around 300 bodies or even more are still in the ground. The bulldozer, one bulldozer, because of the very limited resources working, is working there for the sake of just digging out the bodies. Family members are lined up there. Family members are trying and rushing with passion and with great deal of sorrow to identify the bodies of their dear. Some of them manage to identify the bodies, then you hear the outcry, you hear the people screaming, crying, and mourning the death of their dears. But at the very same time, they feel a little bit relieved because they finally found the body of their dears. I spoke to a mother who's around 42, 43 years old. She was trying to identify her son, and then she found the body of her son. She was crying. The sister also, her daughter was crying, and they were calling for the family to come and join them in the burial, because in our culture as Muslims and Arabs, we find a burial as the best fitting homage for the people who are dead. People are continuously digging out the bodies. People are continuously, and this is very ironic, they're trying to save the dead. People, when they die, are supposed to be resting in peace, and I was saying that people in Gaza, when they die, they're neither resting nor in peace. The bodies, those bodies, were collected twice by the Israeli occupation forces. They were taken for some forensic investigation. They were returned to Nasser Hospital. They're stockpiled in this very big hall, three different halls, and then they were buried. And then a second time, the Israeli occupation forces came back to Nasser Hospital. They invaded all different departments of the hospital. They targeted the specialized surgery department, the reception and emergency, and they once again unearthed those hundreds of bodies and took them once again. And then they returned them to this massive grave. So, the suffering even for the dead people in Gaza is still continuous, and the heartache for their families is non-stop. Every single body that is being unearthed, you find tens of people rushing for the sake of identifying whether those are their relatives or otherwise. You see also many families looking into these individual graves in the Nasser Hospital area. You see written on the tombstone that this guy is a tall guy, he has a long hair, he's wearing a gray shirt, and this is all we know. And then it's up to the family to try and to find, and for people to recall what their dears were wearing the day they were parting from them, what were they wearing the day they were killed. So a very emotionally draining process. The numbers are quite shocking, but the account of the loss and the death that led to that eventual mass grave is extremely shocking, where some of the people, like you have just said, some of the people were tied, some of the people had medical accessories on their hands, like the cannulas, and they, when they were unearthed from the ground, it was apparent that they were buried alive. Some people were tortured. Some of the bodies were extremely mutilated, which means that those bodies, some of their organs were taken by the Israeli occupation. Some lost their eyes. I could see some bodies with no eyes. I could see some bodies with no liver, with no kidney. Some bodies that are, you see them, like the outer skin is just covering the skeleton, and that's it. So the account of that experience is quite heart-wrenching. The families that have been suffering for the sake of just identifying their dears are also broken. They have been crying, but at least they say, we feel comfortable because we found our dears. So it gives you an insight, a glimpse into the suffering people of Gaza have been living. It gives you a glimpse into the bereavement the women, men, children, and girls in Gaza have been experiencing for the last 6 months or so.
Akram al-Satri, just for our audience to know, you know, whenever we speak to you, we have, there's this constant noise around you, and those are drones, of course, flying overhead, as they have been for months now. But if you could respond, you know, the European Union, the United Nations, and now also the United States have called for an independent investigation into these mass graves. So your response to that, and we're speaking to you in Rafah, if you could also describe what conditions there are on the ground.
Well, as to the independent scrutiny or investigation committee that needs to be developed, I've been working in journalism for around 16 years now. I have been hearing about the independent committees, commissions, inquiries, fact-finding committees, and international reports and tribunals about the situation in Gaza, looking into the particular details of the incidents that were taking place, investigating the death of several people in mass killing incidents, including the war in 2008, 2008, the war in 2014, and the war in 2021, I have been hearing a book about Gaza and the war in Gaza from 2014, and I was reading the exact word that I'm going to say now: Palestinians struggle to dig out the bodies. So this is something that happened in 2014. This is something that happened in 2008. This is something that happened in 21, 22, and is still happening throughout 2023 and 2024. The international community has failed to preserve and to preserve and observe the dictates of the international humanitarian law. The humanity at large is facing a challenge. All the political systems worldwide are asked now and expected to do something tangible for the sake of just saving the Gaza Strip. Rhetoric is no longer needed. Rhetoric is no longer satisfactory. We need them to do something tangible to stop the things that are happening in Gaza. Some of the things that Gazans are suggesting: the no-fly zone to protect the civilians in Gaza. Some of the things that Gazans are suggesting: that Israel should be held accountable for what they call crimes that were committed against the humanity, against people, against civilians. The international humanitarian law is rich with terms and vocab that are related to the what they call the civil objects that are protected, journalists that are protected, medical teams that are supposed to be protected, medical facilities that are supposed also to be protected. But when you review the shocking numbers about the way that the journalists are being killed, for instance, the medical teams are being killed, for instance, you conclude that the international community is failing so far to do something tangible rather than the statements, the condemnations, the calls for independent inquiries or commissions to look into the investigation. We need something tangible. And that something tangible has not been achieved so far, and Gazans have been dying constantly because of that. Something should be done. Something swift should be done. Otherwise, the death would continue. Now in Gaza today, 79 people were killed, and an average number of around 65 to 79 is killed every day. And if nothing is done, this means the international community accepts the killing of Gazans and accepts the justification of Israel to continue that killing. Sorry. And when it comes to the situation in Rafah, around 1.4 to 1.2 million because of the influx of people from Rafah in the last few days. People are so scared because of the looming ground operation. They understand that the Israeli occupation is going to target them, and they understand that death would be chasing them. So some of them moved from Rafah. Around 150,000 Gazans have already left Rafah and moved to the area in Al-Mawasi, a buffer zone between Rafah and Khan Yunis, in the hope that they would survive. The ones who are in Rafah and the ones who are in Khan Yunis and the ones in Gaza, at the entirety of Gaza, are on all IDPs, around 2.1 million IDPs, because of the destruction of the infrastructure, the destruction of the homes, the destruction of the streets, and because of the continuous bombardment that has been taking their life. And those people are living in areas that have no infrastructure. No infrastructure means that they don't have water supplies that are regular. They don't have sewage systems. They don't have food. They don't have even drinkable water that with which they can cook the food. They don't have houses. They're living in tents, and today is a very hot day. Today and yesterday were very hot days in this specific season. Now people in the tents are struggling. They're sweating all day. The children that have respiratory, even the adults that have some respiratory disorders, are suffering more than any other people. And this suffering is continuous. And this situation, when it comes to the humanitarian situation in Gaza, is unbearable, unimaginable, and unacceptable. When I tell you the situation is unimaginable, because for me, some parts of Gaza and some part of those camps that I have seen, the suffering of the people is unimaginable. You see them living just by the minimum, and even there is no minimum, and they have no other choice to continue living and waiting and hoping some solution would be developed or concluded sometime soon. This is the truth about the situation. Something I have never seen in my life. let alone someone who's living thousands of miles away from Gaza. People are buried in the streets. People are buried on the pavements. People are buried everywhere in their homes. And some of the bodies, around 10,000 bodies are in Gaza, are still under the rubble, and they have not been retrieved so far. You walk down the streets and you smell death everywhere. You go to the hospital that is supposed to be the temple of protection and humanity. You find the hospital totally devastated by death. You find the patients who were supposed to be receiving the medical treatments buried within the hospital, and you smell their decomposed body after the bodies were desecrated and unearthed. And wherever you turn your face, you see the children, you see the adults, you see the women and the men, the girls and the boys suffering from that unjust situation that is still continuous, and no one single international power could stop that or bring an end to that ongoing suffering and misery.
Akram al-Sathri, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Be safe. Akram is a Gaza-based journalist speaking to us from Rafah.
This is the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm Dave Reed. Student protests over Israel's genocidal war on Gaza are spreading across the United States and around the world. Students at Columbia University in New York set up a protest encampment last week on the campus. In response, the university's president, Nemat Manush Shafiq, called in the New York Police Department, who arrested several student organizers. These students were then banned from campus and may face expulsion. If the goal was to quickly end the protest, this completely backfired on the university administration. Thousands of students, joined by faculty and staff from across the university, reestablished the protest camp almost immediately. Other universities around the United States have seen solidarity camps erected and administration buildings occupied. Now, students around the world are joining the movement. Michael Ari and I spoke to one of the student organizers from Columbia who was arrested and banned from campus. Mariam Iqbal spoke to us on Tuesday. In the second segment, Michael reacts to Summer Lee's primary victory in Pennsylvania and previews his new election season newsletter.
Okay, so to start, I was wondering, you know, we've been covering Columbia obviously for months and really years in many ways when it comes to this issue. I think, you know, maybe people who have seen the news of the encampments are coming into the story only recently and don't really know some of the history leading up to this moment, particularly dating back to the fall when JVP and SJP chapters on campus were banned or suspended by the administration. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the climate on the campus kind of leading up to these recent protests.
Yeah, for sure. So prior to October, there really was no SJP. I mean, there was the SJP Instagram. I would DM them occasionally trying to join, and there was just no activity. I went to the club fair in September, and SJP wasn't even there. I remember JVP was taking signatures for SJP. And then in October, everything started. SJP finally got into movement. We had our first protest on October 12th, and the numbers were insane. We didn't expect it at all. There were hundreds of people showing up for Palestine, and we would protest consistently, and up to the point of suspension, the majority of our threats were external Zionist organizations, such as like the guys behind the doxing trucks, or just in general, our main concern used to be doxing. But when November came around, we started getting a lot more disciplinary threats from the administration regarding unsanctioned protests, because I believe administration realized we weren't going to stop protesting as they had hoped. So that led up to the suspension of SJP and JVP for not complying with the rules for booking a protest many days in advance, which we had explained to administration was an unreasonable demand considering the urgency of the genocide. So once SJP and JVP were suspended by Columbia without following the correct procedure, there was a lot of outcry from the student body. It really, really galvanized the student body. And that caused a coalition to reform actually, because CU Apartheid Divest existed prior to October, but it was just, nobody was really talking about CU Apartheid Divest until SJP was suspended. So we have a coalition now of 120 plus student organizations at Columbia, who are all in solidarity with the fight for Palestinian liberation. And since then, we've had protests, teach-ins, and all of these different events, but it's been very difficult because of administrative crackdown on us.
And I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about some of the mainstream coverage that we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think it's really frustrating to see, especially the hyperfixation on campus safety. That's been something that has been at the front of all these conversations for the last few months. And that's the reason that I have been avoiding speaking to media up till now, because I don't like talking about campus safety when there's no universities left in Gaza. Like, I don't want to center myself or any college student for that matter when, I mean, it's nothing compared to what's happening in Palestine. And I think it's a huge distraction. And right now we're looking at the media. They're really like mischaracterizing what the encampment is. They're talking about like, I mean, it sounds like a battleground the way they're describing it, but really when you go there, it's very peaceful and they're characterizing us as very anti-Semitic. But there's, I mean, we're celebrating Jewish holidays on the encampment with our Jewish comrades. So it's just very misleading how they're portraying the encampment. And another thing that's really frustrating to me is the way in which Western media outlets have been reporting on the encampment itself, but without reporting on our demands or on the genocide that we are protesting. Because obviously we're protesting for a reason. We're not just causing a disruption for the fun of it. And it's been really upsetting to see this focus on just this hyperfixation on elite college campuses over the actual atrocities happening in Palestine.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit more about the coalition that is engaged in this encampment protest? You mentioned that you've been celebrating Jewish holidays, Jewish traditions during this current encampment protest. And of course, the accusations of anti-Semitism have become kind of the central focus of Zionist anti-Palestinian opposition groups. Can you talk about like who exactly, you know, from the Columbia student body is engaged in the encampment protest?
Yeah, so I would actually say that Jewish students are disproportionately represented in our encampment. I mean, JVP members and Jews for Ceasefire, those are two organizations that of anti-Zionist Jewish students, and they both shown out in such huge numbers to our encampment. And I think it's just very deeply insulting to them to be erasing their participation in this encampment as, I mean, it's so central to the encampment. And like, ever since October, SJP and JVP have been working in complete coalition since the very start. I mean, SJP doesn't do anything without JVP. We fully work together. And when the coalition formed, then we introduced all these other groups like the Black Students Organization, Muslim Students Association, and all of these other groups. But from the very start, it's been SJP and JVP.
Yeah. What are the specific demands that this encampment protest has given to the Columbia administration?
Yeah. So we're just occupying the lawn until divestment happens, because all of our protests from the very start have had the demand of divestment from all like Zionist institutions, ending the dual degree program with Tel Aviv University and canceling the opening of the Tel Aviv Global Center. So this is all encompassed in our demand for divestment.
I'm wondering what you've made of the administration's react. I know classes have moved online. They're now remote, but what kind of communication have you had with the administration and how would you assess how they've reacted to the situation so far?
It's been shocking, honestly. Like, I mean, I faced so much administrative repression for the last few months. I've been specifically targeted by both Barnard and Columbia administrations. I think what was shocking to me is that they don't learn from their mistakes, in that when they do these things to suppress students, it only galvanizes the student body even more. So, for example, if I was a Zionist administrator, I would not call the cops on my own students because I know that that would cause mass outrage in the student body and spark a new movement. This is what happened when they suspended SJP and JVP. It revitalized the student movement. So I'm just like, I fully expected administrative crackdown. I'm just surprised that they don't learn from their past mistakes.
We've seen some videos of like, you know, there's that infamous kind of Columbia professor pro-Israel who's staging all these kind of antics. And, you know, I've seen like videos of people waving Israeli flags or like people trying to provoke some sort of reaction. Have you had any interaction with that kind of stuff? And what have you seen in terms of people infiltrating the encampment and maybe trying to provoke something?
I think in the encampment in general, there have been a lot of people trying to provoke things and instigate. But I really feel like student organizers have done a good job of like not getting involved in that kind of stuff. But the problem is everything gets pinned on us regardless of whether or not we were involved in it. but we have a very like strict policy of not engaging with instigators.
And what have you made of the movement spreading? I mean, you know, it's hard to keep up with. It's obviously, you know, more than a dozen, I guess, or maybe it's dozens by now. Universities have started their own encampments. I assume you've been paying attention to this and kind of what do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's just so beautiful to see. I don't think I expected this much to happen. Like, I remember the night I got out of jail, I was just out of jail. I was trying to process everything. And someone comes up to me saying they occupied the other lawn. Like, I was so shocked because obviously when the arrests happened, all of the core student organizers had been arrested and taken to jail. And for the last few months, it felt like we've had to put so much work into keeping the momentum for the students. For example, we would advertise a protest days in advance with a nice, like, pretty graphic so people would show up. And then it's like, we get arrested and they organize their own thing on the spot. So this momentum, I mean, I've never seen anything like it before. And I don't think it'll end until divestment actually happens at every university that is involved in this.
Mariam, can you describe to us what your experience was like with the arrests and as much as you feel comfortable with sharing with our audience, what you're dealing with now in terms of your position with the school and what the administration is doing to you and to other organizers as well that were arrested?
Yeah, for sure. So the morning of the arrests, before the arrests happened, I was suspended at around 10 a.m. with two other students. And these were the only suspensions to happen prior to the arrests. So shortly after we were all arrested, we were zip tied, put into vans, and we spent some time in jail. It was all a blur. I don't really remember much of it. But then after we got out, people started getting a lot of suspension notices from Barnard specifically. And Columbia students started getting suspension notifications when they went to retrieve their belongings that have been confiscated by public safety. And I think they were using that as a way to identify students. So they would show up and immediately get suspended because they were trying to get their belongings. So it's just been very like underhand, like very strange, insidious tactics that they've been using to get people. And I knew that I would be targeted at a more disproportionate level because specifically the Barnard administration has been targeting me for the last few months, me specifically as a member of SJP. So for example, right now, Barnard students got the conduct notice that most of us are being granted amnesty and we can just accept discipline and probation as opposed to just getting suspended. I was one of the four people who did not get that option. And that's what I expected to happen because I think that they have been consistently targeting me a lot. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw like the mugshot type of thing they made of me, like the no entry poster. So when I went to Barnard straight after being let out of jail and I was trying to get in and they weren't letting me, they were treating me like a criminal. For a whole hour, I stood outside, it was midnight. And then they finally let me in and they timed me for 15 minutes on the phone. And the second the timer went off, I had to leave and find my own housing.
I'm so sorry you had to deal with that. Are you in a safe place now? I mean, are you handling this all right?
Yeah, I did have to leave town because unfortunately there's a lot of focus on me specifically in the news. So it's been difficult because of physical threats to my violence.
Oh, really? Yeah. You've received actual physical threats?
Yeah, I was trying to stay around Columbia as long as I could, but I was being physically stalked and recorded by like outside Zionists who I assume had been brought in by a lot of Shai Davidi's tweeting.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry you're having to deal with that.
Yeah.
Going forward, do you have a sense of where the Columbia encampment action is headed now? Are you still engaged in that organizing, even though you're in another location? Or, you know, have you had to step back from some of that organizing?
No, I've been very involved in organizing still. And I'm doing a lot of press stuff right now and handling like comms, basically for SJP. But I do plan on going back, obviously, because I do have a conduct hearing on this Friday. And it's in person and required.
What's next for the Columbia encampment?
I have no idea where it's going because I didn't even expect it to last this long. I really thought we would get swept the first day. Like, I didn't expect this momentum to last. I have very strong faith that we will win our demands from this. I just don't know how long it'll take, but I don't think students are going to let up anytime soon.
Mm. Well, it's really been inspiring watching the students at Columbia, and what you helped to spark has now gone around the world. And it seems like we're witnessing a wave of student activism around Palestine that is really unprecedented. And a lot of that has to do with what you all did at Columbia. And I know you were a central figure in that. So thank you so much for your efforts, and stay strong, and we'll keep in touch with you and other students there at Columbia as this continues to unfold.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to the 2024 election. 2 years ago, AIPAC spent over $4 million to defeat Summer Lee in Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district. Despite that huge amount of money, Lee won by less than 1,000 votes. This year, anti-Palestinian groups pulled out of the race and didn't spend any money to defeat Lee, who easily won her primary last night. Michael, what's the importance of last night's race?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups like Democratic Majority for Israel spent heavily when Summer Lee first ran for this seat a couple years ago. And yeah, she only narrowly won by, like I say, by less than 1,000 votes, less than a point. So I think the expectation was that this time around, and AIPAC obviously spends the most money when we talk about these pro-Israel groups, it was fully expected that they would return, that they would spend big money again, and that Summer Lee was potentially in a vulnerable position. And the reality is they did not show up. That's correct. And I think that was surprising to everyone. And I think the big story out of this election is them not showing up and kind of viewing Lee's race as an unwinnable one, right? I mean, she fended off a challenge from a Edgewood council member named Bhavini Patel, who was, we should point out, backed by a PAC called Moderate PAC, which was specifically formed, I think, about a year ago to target progressive candidates. And it's primarily funded by Republican billionaire Jeffrey Yass, who, you know, intervenes a lot in all kinds of elections, but his main focus is not Israel. So we should mention that, you know, Lee was up against some big, I think something like $600,000 maybe was spent in terms of ads, but Lee herself did not accept any money from corporate PACs, unlike her opponent. But I think, you know, the big story here is that we've seen in recent years, of course, poll after poll showing us that Democratic voters, not Democratic lawmakers, there's still a lag there. Summer Lee still represents kind of an outlier when it comes to even the House. She, you know, she's part of this wider progressive group, sometimes referred to as the Squad, who have been consistently critical of Israel and have backed a ceasefire from the very beginning. You know, she was one of the first House members to back a ceasefire. Virtually no one else did back in November, shortly after October 7th. And like I said, the numbers indicate that the Democratic base agrees with politicians like Summer Lee, like Rashida Tlaib, like Ilhan Omar when it comes to this issue. There was a poll a couple months ago from Data for Progress that actually found that 77%, just a, you know, like a staggering number of Democratic voters believe that President Biden should demand a permanent ceasefire in the region. And those numbers are pretty high even among independents. That same poll found that 69% of independents said they backed a ceasefire. So I think a couple things happened here. The first thing is that the ceasefire position is broadly popular among Democratic voters and certainly voters in her 12th congressional district in Pennsylvania, you know, which includes Pittsburgh and other places. And the attacks that she kind of endured, because AIPAC had originally had looked to target her at the very beginning of this race. And shortly after that began, and then shortly after Jeffrey Yass' involvement became public, Lee broke big records for herself in terms of donations. So she had this massive fundraising haul in the fourth quarter of 2023, raised over $1 million, and over 90% of those donations were less than $250. So, you know, you have people in the community or maybe throughout the United States who saw these attacks on Lee and decided to support her. So I think that's the big story here because, you know, AIPAC is set to spend over $100 million during this election. They will definitely be heard from. I don't think, you know, this is a sign that AIPAC will have no impact on our 2024 election, obviously. But this is, I think this is a huge story insofar as we saw somebody who people thought may have been vulnerable over her position on Palestine. And it seems to have been the exact opposite.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, Summer Lee is a member of the so-called Squad in Congress, along with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Jamal Bowman, a few others. They're using a lot of anti-AIPAC rhetoric in their campaigns this year, much stronger language than any candidates I can recall who were either incumbents or who had the potential to pull out a victory. What do you make of that strategy?
I would think, you know, I kind of alluded to this already, I think when we see that kind of rhetoric, we have to remember that it's happening amid these massive kind of historic protests throughout the United States, right? The biggest anti-war protests that we've seen in the country in 20, or I guess over 20 years now, that's 2024. So, you know, there's this real momentum and support for a ceasefire and support for Palestine. And, you know, people are becoming more and more skeptical of Israel. And I think, you know, when that happens, when the public shifts, you know, naturally you see the rhetoric of politicians shift, or, you know, there's more room for that type of criticism. Last night during her victories, or after her victory effectively became apparent, Lee tweeted, "Opposing genocide is good politics and good policy," which is a direct swipe at AIPAC, who is always tweeting that, you know, Democrats being pro-Israel is good politics and good policy. So, you know, here we see a woman who just won her race by a pretty hefty margin, I think over 20 points with 95% of the vote in right now, using the word genocide to describe the situation in Gaza. That's part of it, I think, the fact that there's been this momentum among the general public and support for a ceasefire, and, you know, also a deep skepticism of big money, of dark money in politics. The other thing I'd say in the case of AIPAC, of course, they've run into a lot of backlash actually in the last few years. A couple years ago, when they first established these PACs to donate directly to candidates or to oppose candidates directly in the Democratic primaries, they, of course, also began giving money directly to Republicans, many of whom, you know, refused to certify Biden's election in 2020. So I think that's also part of it, that AIPAC has really come under criticism from maybe people who aren't even consistently critical of Israel, just for, you know, their open support for Republicans and races. I think, you know, Democrats look at this and say, why is there a group that, you know, supports pro-Trump politicians, pro-January 6th insurrection politicians? Why are they able to intervene in Democratic primaries, spend big money, and have an impact? And, you know, Summer Lee is kind of a very important part of that story. The AIPAC, as you mentioned, spent over $4 million trying to stop her twice. If they had actually spent in last night's election and lost, it would be, of course, the third time that they had actually lost to Summer Lee, I think, which would be terrible for their kind of optics, because they obviously want to project this kind of image as a powerful force in American politics. And in the case of Lee, you know, she beat in 2022 a guy named Steve Irwin, who was a former Republican staffer who was backed by AIPAC. And then she went on to beat GOP candidate Mike Doyle. And that AIPAC intervened in that race, too. And that was the first time that AIPAC had ever intervened directly against a Democrat in a general election. So, yeah, I think we'll see more and more criticism of AIPAC and more attempts to kind of stop it. And we've even seen some efforts that, you know, we saw recently a coalition of progressive groups band together, calling themselves Reject AIPAC, and are working kind of directly, you know, on the Hill to try to stop them and lobby from the opposite direction. You know, they obviously don't have anywhere near the money that a group like AIPAC does, but I think we can see that, especially in the case of Summer Lee, you know, activism and grassroots politics can sometimes, you know, beat back that big money.
Yeah. And what about this state treasurer race in Pennsylvania that happened last night? I know that wasn't on our radars, but it had some interesting Israel connections.
Yeah, I don't think it was on anyone's. I certainly barely saw anything about it going into this race. But a woman named Erin McClelland, who was a Democrat who ran for state treasurer, she actually opposed investing Pennsylvania's state pension funds in Israeli bonds. And that came in response to this additional $20 million that the current Republican state treasurer invested in Israeli bonds shortly after the Hamas attack of October 7th. So, yeah, I mean, it's maybe a small thing. I don't know how much it would get covered, but it's kind of just another example of how, you know, this assumption that if you push back against Israel in any capacity or push back against the idea that they should be given effectively unlimited aid, that makes you politically vulnerable and you can't possibly win office in the United States. And I think it's just another example of how that might be changing.
Hundreds of students at Columbia University and City University of New York were arrested last night after hundreds of police officers carrying shields and in full riot gear raided Columbia to break up a Gaza solidarity encampment set up almost 2 weeks ago that has inspired similar encampments in over 40 universities across the country, including CUNY. Students at Columbia took over Hamilton Hall a day earlier after the school began suspending defending students who refused to leave the Gaza Solidarity encampment. Students renamed the building Hinz Hall in honor of Hind Rajab, a six-year-old Palestinian girl killed by the Israeli military in Gaza. The police raid began after Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq sent a letter to the New York City Police Department calling for the encampment and Hamilton Hall to be cleared. She wrote, quote, "I have determined that the building occupation, the encampments and related disruptions pose a clear and present danger to persons, property and the substantial functioning of the university," unquote. President Shafiq also asked the police to remain presence on campus until at least May 17th, 2 days after graduation, to ensure, she said, that solidarity encampments are not reestablished. Columbia's graduation is scheduled for May 15th. Hundreds of officers entered the campus through the main gates and encircled the encampment inside last night. Police also pulled a truck outside Hamilton Hall, extended a ladder to a second-story window for a stream of officers to climb into the building. Further uptown from Columbia, at the City College of New York, police in riot gear raided the Gaza Solidarity encampment after the administration made a similar call for the police to enter campus. Scores of students and CUNY community members were arrested. Overnight, the department shared a video on social media showing officers lowering a Palestinian flag atop the City College flagpole, balling it up and throwing it to the ground before raising the American flag. Over the past 2 weeks, police have swept through other campuses holding peaceful Gaza Solidarity encampments across the country. Over 1,200 students and others have been arrested. In a moment, we'll be joined by two Columbia University students who are on campus during the police raid. But first, Democracy Now! Was on the streets last night outside Columbia. I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! We're standing at 113th and Broadway. It's about 10:30 at night. The riot police have lined up here, and it is a complete frozen zone from here up to Columbia University. We understand that they've moved in on Hamilton Hall, that the students have occupied, and we understand arrests are underway, though we haven't seen it. There was a group of protesters here, but they say they're going to do jail support. They're going down to One Police Plaza. Let's see if we can find them and ask them why they're out here. What's your name?
I'm Jeannie. I am an organizer with Warriors in the Garden. I am a first-generation Korean American. I am a shamed alumni of NYU. We are out here as people whose ethnic roots originate in the global south to stand against settler colonialism, because no matter how it looks in every form, it kills. And we will not be complicit anymore. And this is a very historic moment where our youth in our country are leading the revolution, and it is all of our responsibilities to not put that, to not just be like, oh, they're so brave, but to be to have that incite something within us.
My name is Sam. I'm an organizer, and I'm here to show support for the students. I think that I've been pro-Palestinian my whole life, as is my family. I'm Iranian, and we have always found the liberation of Palestinian people to be essential to our liberation as Iranians and everybody's, you know, collective liberation.
We're standing in Amsterdam and 113th Street. It's about 10:30, 11 at night. Why are you here?
So I'm a Brown University alum, and as you know, one of our own, Hisham Awartini, was shot. And also, I have a Palestinian friend who told me that for speaking out on Palestine, he's been doxxed. I mean, and he's been kicked off campus. He's lost his housing and food, and he has no family here. But he feels the need to speak on it because his cousins and family members are under the rubble right now, and he can't reach a lot of his cousins. And so, knowing that, you know, there's not a lot of degree of separation between Hisham and I and our other colleague that also lost family members and has been doxxed and kicked off campus, this is the least that we can do to support our friends.
Is this why you're wearing a mask even though we're outside?
Absolutely. And we're not wearing a mask because we're scared, but we're doing this because this is what our predecessors have told us this is the right way to protest. And this is what we need to do to protect ourselves while also speaking and standing up for what's true.
So I understand there's an encampment at Brown, too, and there's a slogan, from Columbia to Brown, we won't let Gaza down. Yeah. Have you heard the latest from there?
So today, actually, Brown University passed a resolution in order to compromise with the students' encampments, that they're going to vote in October on divestment. So I think that's a big victory for the student encampments, for the 41 students who were arrested, and also for the students who were doing the hunger strike, as you may know. So, yeah, the agreeing to vote on divestment is a big step for the student organizers, and they're very proud of it, and I think that's the least we can do as alum to support them.
We've just spoken to some people who are supporting the students now. The bus of arrested students is coming through.
Back up.
Are these the buses?
The buses are coming up. Please back up.
These are the arrested students.
Please back up.
Are they buses?
I'm not sure who's in the buses. I know the buses are leaving. Please back up.
The police have arrested someone. People are shouting shame. He's on the ground.
Back up, back up, back up, back up, back up, back up. Let's go. Move, move, move. Back up, back up.
Back up.
What's your name?
Back up.
What's your name? Over 230 students and their allies were arrested at Columbia University last night when the Columbia president okayed the presence of the New York Police Department and their raid of the university. Dozens of others were arrested just 20 blocks north at City College. For more on the police raid at Columbia, we're joined by two guests. Cameron Jones is a Columbia student with Jewish Voice for Peace. He was outside Hamilton Hall when police pushed everyone into nearby buildings and stormed the hall. Cameron is a 19-year-old urban studies major. He's joining us here in studio. And Jillian Goodman is with us, a student at Columbia Journalism School covering Columbia's ongoing student protests since the first days of the encampments. She joins us via video stream. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jillian Goodman, no relation that we know of. Jillian, why don't you describe what happened on campus? I mean, what's really fascinating here is the Columbia J School, the journalism school, overlooks the police raid. And, in fact, Columbia journalism students and other students who were covering this event were told by police they'd be arrested if they didn't stay inside. Jillian, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely happy to be here. That's correct, Amy. And in fact, the only reason that we were able to have access to campus, many of us in the journalism school, is that we had slept in the building the night before. They had restricted campus to only those students in residential dorms. So the only reason we were able to witness what we were able to witness is because we had stayed in the building. When police arrived, they were extremely efficient in removing all eyewitnesses, including legal observers. Myself and my colleagues at the journalism school were pushed with police batons to our backs and corralled out of the space. So we were not able to witness the arrests head on, but some journalism students were able to remain in the building to overlook the side of Hamilton Hall. But they were extremely clear and efficient that they were not to have any eyewitnesses, including the majority of press, during the time that the arrests were made.
And Jillian, was there any warning beforehand or any sense that the arrests were coming?
There had been a sense for a few hours as police gathered outside. I would say that no one knew the exact moment they were going to come in, but we knew pretty clearly within about a 30-minute window. I think there was a tremendous sense of trepidation, but also resolve on campus that I saw from a lot of the organizers. We were also served an emergency alert from emergency management that went throughout to all Columbia students, issuing a shelter-in-place warning in the hour before the arrests happened. And so most students were corralled into their dorm by campus safety. And that was our tell that the arrests were imminent.
We're also joined by Cameron Jones of Jewish Voices for Peace. Cameron, what did you see last night?
Yeah, so I was also one of the students who was forced into a nearby building once the police arrived on the scene. And it was very clear that the university and the police did not want any witnesses to the police brutality that was going to take place. They even pushed medics and legal observers into nearby buildings, preventing them from doing their jobs. And then we got a slew of footage from onlookers that protesters were pushed and shoved. Individuals were thrown downstairs. One individual was left unconscious for a few minutes. There was also the police using tasers on peaceful protesters and also using a smoke bomb inside occupied Hind Hall. So it's very clear that the police used very aggressive and very violent tactics to suppress peaceful protesters.
And what about you? You were outside. You didn't occupy Hamilton Hall. You were at the encampment. Do you face suspension?
As of now, I am not sure what the university will do. Unfortunately, the university has arbitrarily suspended dozens of students already, so I would not be surprised if I do end up facing suspension, unfortunately.
The response of the students to the president, although on Friday saying she would not call New York police on campus, calling in those police who raided Hamilton Hall last night.
Yeah, so the president is definitely acting in bad faith, I would say. She really seems to be doing anything in her power to suppress student activism on campus, and that includes bringing in violent police to violently arrest hundreds of people. And it really appears as though the president has not learned her lesson from arresting people a few weeks ago, because the students only come back with more fury and with more intensity in regards to our activism.
Cameron, I wanted to ask you about the role of the faculty. Many of the faculty condemned the last raid, or the first raid that occurred a couple of weeks ago. Were there faculty out there trying to interpose themselves between the students and the police this time?
I did not see a substantial faculty presence, but we have had faculty very present at the encampment acting as security, and we have widespread faculty support in terms of our opinions towards the administration. Faculty is on our side in condemning what the administration has been doing.
And Julian Goodman, you have both President Shafik and New York City Mayor Adams painting the takeover of Hamilton Hall as a takeover by outside agitators. What was your sense of who was inside Hamilton Hall?
Yes, so I was there the night that the occupation occurred. There's no way to know exactly who was involved, but I know firsthand that there is a large student presence. And also the thing that surprised me the most was a massive student support outside. There was a human chain linked arm in arm to protect the building that was 200 students strong. And those are people that I know to be students of Columbia and Barnard in a large majority. So I think that mostly this is an effort by administration to distance these actions from the students, though I know that they are deeply resolved and in support.
Let me ask Cameron Jones. Columbia student has sued Columbia for creating a hostile environment against Jews. You're with Jewish Voice for Peace. I want to turn right now to a clip. This is Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson facing heckling and boos when he came to Columbia University a few days ago, calling for President Biden to call in the National Guard to bring order to the campus where the students set up the encampment last week. He also called for Columbia President Manu Shafiq to step down. Columbia students criticized Johnson's visit.
I am here today joining my colleagues and calling on President Shafiq to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear.
If you can talk about that as a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, Cameron.
Yes. So I think as a Jewish student on campus who represents a group of dozens of Jewish individuals, I would like to note that Jewish students have been part of the protest movement on campus since October. And there have been dozens of Jewish students who have been arrested for pro-Palestine demonstrations. So I think it's really important to recognize that there is a large anti-Zionist Jewish voice on campus. And it's also important to recognize the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionism is a political ideology, while anti-Semitism is in regards to Judaism, which is a culture and a religion. And it's important to know the distinction between the two. And I think oftentimes in the mainstream media and on campus, there is a conflation of the two. And it's really important to recognize that there has been an intense amount of hostility towards pro-Palestine protesters on campus. We have faced harassment. We have faced physical and verbal intimidation. I myself have been doxxed and have faced death threats online. I have been harassed on campus by multiple individuals.
And explain what you mean by doxxed.
Yeah, so I've had my personal information published online, including pictures, social media, my LinkedIn profile, etc., in which people can message me death threats and email me horrible information. And the university has done nothing to protect pro-Palestine voices and has been really cracking down on anyone who is standing up for Palestinian rights. And this really just shows how Columbia University is using similar tactics that the apartheid state of Israel is using to crack down on Palestinians in occupied Palestine. Hmm.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but I do want to ask Jillian Goodman, the president of Columbia, the president of Barnard, has already had an overwhelming no-confidence vote by the faculty. President of Columbia says she's asked the police to maintain a presence on campus through May 17th, 2 days after graduation. What are you expecting? As we saw yesterday, the campus almost completely shut down. Professors had their IDs canceled. Students couldn't, unless they lived right there on the campus, get in.
Yes, I think those actions shattered a sense that there is free and open access to our own resources and our own campus. The ways that they were really effectively able to bar anyone from that, I think there's really profound disappointment and anger coming from Shafiq's decision to retain a police presence on campus, as that has consistently been an ask, I think, from all sides, is to remove the police presence. And that is often what creates a threat and intimidation of violence, much more so than the protests on campus. I watched the police at around 2 a.m. load the encampment into a trash compacting dumpster, and I watched the community guidelines get crushed. And I think that, to me, was the perfect moment of seeing what that effect can be of having that police presence on campus.
Jillian Goodman, a Columbia Journalism School student covering Columbia's ongoing student protests since the first days of the encampments, and Cameron Jones, Columbia College student with Jewish Voice for Peace. We thank you so much for being with us.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Zachary's singer Andrea Superstein is one of the most versatile voices in music today. The new album, Oh Mother, is an ambitious tour de force, highlighting her ever-growing creativity and sensitivity as a songwriter and arranger. Oh Mother is available now. Andrea will be performing at Upstairs Jazz Club in Montreal on Friday, May 3rd. For more information about the show, visit upstairsjazz.com.
But I've been waiting all my life for this. All the lips that tell me lies, and I can't wait to kiss. Tell your little buddy kitty, put him in a chokehold. Cap all on your tongue, but how you make it go so loco? I've been running circles, I've been putting in the time. Baby, shut the door and keep on telling me the mess. We argue all day. Love the hard way, yeah. And ain't no making that right. But would you please stay the next day? Please stay the next day. That dick is golden. That dick is golden.
Yeah, okay, I got it.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to The Venus Show here on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. I'm here with Sara.
Hi, guys. I'm so happy to be back again.
Yes, she was here a couple weeks back for our March mix, I think. The song you just heard was You Up by Yaya B. I don't know. And we're going to play some songs for you. So, yeah. Enjoy.